I think the average person would want to escape. If you said, let's spend the evening talking about symbolism, and I'm not sure I'd blame her. But the truth is, we all know quite a bit about symbolism. We understand why the oak was picked as a symbol of strength, or the mule as a symbol of stubbornness, or the ring as a symbol of love. Even if we don't talk about such things, we know that a symbol is, first of all, itself, a real thing, and then that it stands for or represents something else. This morning, by recreating a little ancient history, I invite you to be present at the birth of a symbol. It begins with an old story from the book of Exodus, a title which means, literally, the road out. The Jews had escaped their long bondage in Egypt and are now wandering in the desert country at the southeastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. They've been gone long enough to miss the highly spiced foods they ate in Egypt, and they are complaining bitterly to their leader Moses that if he can't do better than this, they are ready to go back. They aren't a very lovable bunch. They complain so much that on one occasion Moses looks to God, shrugs his shoulders with disgust, and says, "What am I? Their mother?" God himself is represented once as saying, "These people are absolutely wearing me out. If I go any further with them on this journey, I may not be able to keep myself from simply wiping them out." For the God of the Old Testament, that is no idle threat. He had done such things before. I'm sure the English poet, satirist, Hilary Belloc, was thinking of these stories in Exodus when he wrote his naughty little 8-word lyric, "How odd of God to choose the Jews." The writers of Jewish scripture were marvelously honest about themselves. So this is one of their grumbles. If we have to die, it would have been nice to die back in Egypt, where we could all sit down beside a good pot of stew meat. Have you brought us into this desert to starve the whole lot of us to death? There are two versions of what happens next. In one of them, in the book of Numbers, the story is quite natural and without any miraculous element. The people are represented as being tired of something called manna, which the editor of that book describes like this. The manna looked like coriander seed, the color of gum resin. The people went about collecting it, ground it up in hand mills, or pounded it into mortars, then boiled it in the pot and made it into cakes. It tasted like butter cakes. When dew fell in the camp at night, the manna fell with it. Students have wanted to know exactly what this substance was, and investigation has shown that the tamarisk bush in the Sinai Desert produces a granular type of sweet manna from pinhead to pea size. It was thought for a long time that the manna was a secretion of the shrub, but later studies led to a conclusion that manna is produced by the excretions of certain scale insects feeding on the trees. In the dry air, the substance quickly changes into drops of sticky solids containing a mixture of three different kinds of sugars. Arabs have collected it and used it as food right up to modern times. Now, all this sounds very natural, like some person lost in the mountains, finding wild berries that keep him alive. But it was a Jewish habit of mind to credit all such happy discoveries to the special intervention of their God. If it rains, Yahweh, which was their holiest name for the deity, turns the spigot. If there is an unexpected windfall, it is his doing and not a lucky accident. So in the Exodus version of the story, a different version, Moses is represented as promising that the manna will appear as a special gift from God. And in one of their later songs, the 78th Psalm, the Israelites said that God had showered this stuff down from the sky for them to eat. They called it the grain of heaven. They called it the bread of angels. Moses, who had lived in that desert country, you may recall, for many, many years, and must have known about manna already, warned his mob of escaped slaves that they could eat it, but that they were not to gather more of it than was sufficient for one man and his family for one day. The theological purpose of the writer is probably to teach that God will take care of each day and that we are not to worry about the next one. That undoubtedly was the theological purpose of the story. But in literal history, the advice of Moses was probably a simple reminder that manna would not keep. It simply did not last past one day. There were, of course, a few hoarders, eager for security, who gathered enough for several days, but on the following morning, the record tells us, they found the stuff stank and was full of worms. Probably, the scholars believe, ants. Beyond this point, I'm not interested in the story except for its function as a religious symbol. The perfect religious symbol should be founded on some real incident which has been mulled over and enriched by one generation after another until it enshrines the experience of thousands of people. Manna is an almost perfect example of such a symbol. It finds expression in the famous prayer Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread," or, as it is in some manuscripts, and probably was when he spoke it, "Give us bread for the day." He knew his listeners would think about the old story of the manna. If you looked at the four lines from the Quaker poet Whittier, which I printed in the bulletin this morning, you can see how he used the symbol. His point is that no rigid creed can ever adapt itself perfectly to our changing needs. The manna gathered yesterday already savors of decay. When John Conley spoke to you a few Sundays back, he expressed this idea very gracefully when he said that some of the old doctrines of his boyhood church no longer hold the importance for him that they once did. That he had later found a great idea to live by in the book of Micah. What feeds the spirit today may not be enough tomorrow. And even if the food is the same, it has to be fresh every day. A person cannot subscribe once for all to a creed and then spend the rest of his life not thinking about it. Someone asked the editor of a chain of trade papers once if he did not have on hand huge stores of illustrations and stories in his office to fill up every page of his journals. He said, "I have none. My motto is, every day the manna fell." He understood the importance of a fresh gathering. I suppose the hoarders in this story stand for something we all feel strongly, the desire for security. It's hard to believe now that when the security offered by insurance was first introduced, many religious people argued that it was unchristian not to trust God. We've not heard that argument in a long time. Few people on earth are as security-minded as we are. And yet the fact remains, and this story symbolizes it, that physical security does not settle all our problems. Jesus put it with his usual insight and brevity when he said, "Man does not live by bread alone." After we solve the physical problems, we still have to deal with the issues of being creatures of mind and spirit, and we can't gather and store up certain sentiments and values without finding that they go sour if they are not constantly being authenticated by new experiences. Experiences which may require that they flex a little. For example, if you take something like culture for granted, living on the manna gathered yesterday, it may start to sour. There was a time when no one was thought to be educated in the very highest degree unless his PhD came from Germany. But in the late 1930s, that country fell into the most terrible barbarism in modern history because even its cultivated people listened to a promise and lived on the past and chose to close their eyes to what was happening in the present. It's the same with the church. It has to win its life every morning or lose it. We are always a single generation away from annihilation. All we have to do is fail to make what happens here relevant in some way to people sitting out there in their early 20s and 30s, and the whole thing will end. The manna symbol works for education as well. Nothing is more discouraging than the average college graduate about 10 years after he leaves school. New ideas at one time excited and challenged him, now they are a bore. A book is something to dust occasionally. He reads the sports page, she reads about fashion. Their world has shrunk to Dallas and Dynasty. The manna gathered yesterday has become useless. It doesn't have to be that way. I had an interesting experience one time with a man I had hired to hang some wallpaper. One of the first things he said to me was, "You know, I just hung some paper for a lady in her son's bedroom, and the paper had graffiti all over it." He was intrigued. I had to leave just then, but as I drove off, I thought, he may be the only paper hanger I have ever met who knows how to say that word, much less what it means. And by the way, I was thinking in stereotypes. I had all paper hangers stamped out of the same mold I needed a lesson. I was curious, so when I came back, I got this man started talking and found out that he had gone out to the university and taken night courses in philosophy and logic just because he wanted to stretch his mind. He looked down at me from the ladder and said, "What do you think about Plato's theory of pre-existence?" Here was a man gathering his manna fresh. The symbol works for marriage. You can't put a marriage on ice as a guarantee against the future. You have to win what's good in it constantly. Some people know that. Some never learn. They said, "I love you," a few times a long time back, and they sent flowers. She spoke love through a dinner by candlelight. They hoarded up a nice little stock of sentiment. Somehow that ought to last. The trouble is, like manna, it has a way of going rancid unless one gathers fresh every morning. And sobering as the thought may be, even our character is not as stable as we may think. It has to be nourished by contemplation and by practice every day, or we may find it in some moment of crisis to be worm-eaten. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German Christian imprisoned by the Nazis, who finally killed him before the Allied armies could reach him to set him free. In one of his inspirational letters from the concentration camp, he said, "I believe God will give us all the power we need to resist in all the times of distress, but he never gives it in advance, lest we should rely upon ourselves and not on him alone." There's the symbol again. The manna gathered yesterday is not enough. Each day there has to be a new commitment to faith and hope and labor. Moses insisted in the old story on a kind of discipline, and people who refused the discipline paid a price. So let the story of the manna serve one last time as a symbol for discipline, the thing we all tend to resist until a day comes when we know how much it's worth. I think one of the most poignant things I have ever read was an interview a sociologist had with some teenagers about their impressions of their homes and their parents. I used it once a dozen years ago, where some of you may have heard it. I like it so well that I plan to use it again in about a year when I do a series of sermons about children and parents and homes. But right now, I want it for this sermon. He discovered, this sociologist, that the children who were never disciplined came to see it not as a blessing, but as a bitter loss in their growing up. One girl told him she lived in an apartment in a big city, and after supper in the summer, the children on the block would gather in the streets to play. But after a while, one would say she had to go home because her mother had told her to be in before 8 o'clock. Or a father would whistle, and a boy would have to leave. A mother would call, and others would troop off toward their houses. The girl said they would all go. It would get dark, and I would be there alone, waiting for my father or my mother to call me in. They never did. She had lived to learn that if they had loved her more, they would have had some rules. If you believe the Bible still has relevance to modern life, You know already that discipline is a sign of caring, not a sign of indifference. One of the writers, in fact, says, if God loves you, he will chasten you. I have thought sometimes that to view discipline, chastening, disappointment, frustration, as a sign of God's caring may be the most useful faith a human being can hold. Because it means that we can trust each day without fear, and that we can find, even in our disappointments, a proof that we matter. We can face almost anything if we can be sure of that. In the old Hebrew story, when the dew fell, the manna fell with it. When the morning sun came up, the manna was waiting. Each day brought the blessing. Each day still does, for those who know where to look.